And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
This is The Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Greetings and welcome to Starkville.
Baseball Hall of Famer Jason Stark.
And then the robot said, strike.
That's why you're going in the Hall of Fame.
It's an inside the park home run, Doug Glanville.
Mike Trout is coffee at Starbucks with a double latte, skinny.
Doug, are you ready to make some podcast magic?
I am ready. Bring on the magic wand. Let's do it.
Greetings and welcome to Starkville, now part of the Athletic Baseball Show, where you'll find great baseball talk all week long and all season long. I'm Jason Stark. I write about baseball for The Athletic, and I'm joined once again by my good friend, writer, broadcaster, professor, distinguished former major leaguer, and the voice of Sunday Night Baseball on ESPN Radio, Doug Glanville. So, Doug, yeah. I've relocated my half of Starkville to one of your favorite places on earth, Clearwater, Florida. How jealous are you, huh?
Oh, good days, good days. Although I was in Orlando not long ago, so I do feel good about hitting 85 degrees, and I will be shoveling the snowstorm that's coming to Connecticut tonight, so whatever.
Okay, well, we're good. My heart aches for you. You know, just so you know, I do drive a lot here. Like, I can drive 1,500 miles in a spring easily. I've done 3,000 miles in a spring if I really put my mind to it. I had a leisurely little 15-hour workday Saturday thanks to the insane game that I covered that we'll talk about in a moment. The first ever clock-off where the Braves-Red Sox game ended on a pitch clock violation. We're going to have a little fun with that one, but just let people know. Also going to talk with this week's special visitor to Starkville, the great Mets broadcaster Gary Cohen, about the rules, about the Mets, and just a little spoiler alert, Doug, about one of the greatest moments in baseball history. And if you're a member of the Gary Cohen fan club, and you should be if you're not, then you know exactly what moment I'm talking about. Okay. But first, you and I need to talk about these new rules because Doug, seriously, it's pretty close to the only thing that people in spring training are buzzing about, at least to me. Okay,
yes.
I missed a rule change. Let's give a quick recap of the impact of the pitch clock in the first weekend. Average time of game, I believe it's 22 minutes, might be 23 minutes shorter than last year this time. Two hours and 39 minutes, which is about what Major League Baseball thinks the games are going to average during the season. So last spring, at this point, the games were averaging over 3 hours. This year, as we're recording this, we've only had six games in the whole sport that have gone over 3 hours, and it would only be three if the Diamondbacks weren't playing because they played half of them. So what do you think, Doug? Do you see any downside to that?
I don't. I'm just thinking about calling a game out west and catching a flight. I have 30 extra minutes all of a sudden, so that's like kind of interesting. But, you know, they probably are saying, like, why did we do this sooner? But, you know, I understand the hesitation. You know, the purist side of, like, baseball's never on a clock kind of thing. But it was needed, and it seems like it's just reset the whole game.
Well, we're just beginning to reset. And I think the games have a rhythm to them, even in spring training, that baseball games have not had in decades. Yeah. And those 22, 23 minutes that they have cut off the games, it's all dead time, all of it. And I personally don't miss any of that. So that's the good news. But I do want to talk to you about what I saw Saturday. Doug, let me ask you this. What were the odds that the first game that I would attend with this clock this spring would be just a random game, Northport, Florida, and that would be the one game, the only game in the first weekend that ended on a pitch clock violation? Is it me? Like, I picked that game almost at random based on other stuff I was working on, and then that happened. Do you think there's some sort of strange but true magnetic field that hovers over my head or something?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, after you are what I call wackiness royalty, and I think that's great. When you enter,
you mean
the
that's
building,
a compliment,
you
know, right?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. And it's just, I think it all sort of funnels around you, and it sort of flows through you. So when your presence is there, I think all the wacky things decide to show up and show off for what is the king.
I guess I willed it. I don't know. I don't know how I did, but apparently I did. My wife even said when I walked in the door 15 hours after I left, like, you made this happen. You wanted this to happen. You willed it to happen. Maybe I did. I didn't know I did. But let me tell you about how that game ended and how nuts it was. I don't know how much people have focused on the details, but it's the bottom of the ninth. The Red Sox blow a three-run lead. The game's going to take like 220. All hell breaks loose. So they blow a three-run lead. It's 6-6. So Alex Cora brings in a minor league pitcher named, I'm going to try to pronounce this right, Robert Kwiatkowski. Okay, so it's two outs, bases loaded. He goes 3-2 on the hitter. I want you to hear what happened next.
Uh-oh. And now what?
He's out.
They have called strike three. Wow! This is mayhem! Oh! Automatic strike three called with the bases loaded in a tie game in the bottom of the ninth. This is baseball in 2023.
Oh, the two strike strikeout. That's it?
That's right. You got all that, Doug? That was a pitcher striking out a hitter on a 3-2 pitch that he never actually threw. Doug, you have any thoughts just on that concept?
Well, I think you just stared it into existence. Sometimes that's the power of the mind. You could stare your way into a strikeout. That's the next level. I think that's where baseball is going to go. And eventually you have Moneyball. You're going to have ESP ball, where people can see the future, clairvoyance ball. So that must have been what happened there.
I don't know. I guess. Okay. So, look, here's the backstory that I think will explain why everyone in the park was so totally confused by what got called there. Okay. So the pitch is thrown. It's 3-2. The catcher is this guy named Eli Marrero. He throws the ball back to the pitcher. So what happens? The clock starts. But then, yes. Okay, he's standing up. And he's signaling to the infielders, all right, if there's a ground ball hit, the play's at first base. Of course, 3-2, two outs, let's get this game over with. And so as he's doing all this, the clock is ticking down, and he's still standing there. So the hitter,
this total genius right there.
It turned out to be. He didn't know it was. Yeah. But, okay, so the hitter is this guy, Cal Conley. So he's not looking at the pitcher. He's totally distracted by the catcher who's standing there a few inches away from him. And because the catcher is standing and he's not crouching, the pitcher never throws a pitch. And now the clock is down to zero. The umpire's waving his arms. So the hitter thinks he just walked. The managers of both teams think he just walked. The guy on the mound tells me later he had no idea what just happened. He just walked in the winning run despite never throwing a pitch. But that is not the call. The plate ump rules that despite all this chaos that's going all around this guy, the hitter still needs to be looking at the pitcher with 8 seconds left on the clock. Apparently that's true if there's an earthquake, hurricane, whatever, okay? That's but because he's looking at the catcher and not the pitcher, the call is violation on him, and he's out. And that seemed totally illogical to me. It obviously seemed illogical to Cal Conley, who's the hitter. MLB said that's the correct call. Right, my personal opinion is it can't be. The pitcher's not ready to pitch. The catcher is not ready to catch. And somehow it's the hitter who's out. But that's right. Is not what MLB told us, or they told both teams. So, Doug, who's right? Is it MLB and the umpire, or is it me?
Well,
I
like where they're going here. You have to be in some sort of special Zen mode as a hitter, and you need to be in the box staring. If a pitcher could be invisible, you got to be locked in. It's like hitting off of Iron Mike in the batting cage when you go, to Lyndhurst, New Jersey, and hit in the cage. You got to be in the zone. So it's going to look a little weird, and it's a little awkward that you're standing in the box ready to hit. There's nobody there. But that was the genius of Marrero, to create the distraction. It's sort of like in Puerto Rico, we had like the salsa band. That is a genius move by Marrero. You create the band, you have the music, you have fireworks going off. The hitter doesn't know what's going on, and then his 8 seconds runs out. And you do it at the bottom of the ninth with two outs, two strikes, basically. Genius. So I think all these teams are going to come up with all kinds of strategies against that.
There are going to be a lot of great strategies.
Oh, absolutely.
Is it genius if you don't do it on purpose? Because I'm pretty sure he didn't.
Okay. It's sort of a surprise genius. That's it. It's when you surprise yourself.
Yeah, I guess unintentional genius might be a thing. One more thing before we bring in Gary Cohen. When a game ends on a clock violation, what should we call it? You might remember, it's a crazy thing. Okay, I wrote my big spring preview column a week or so ago. And in that column, I quoted an executive of one team literally asking me that question. What are we going to call it when it happens? Because it's totally going to happen. And then I'm there when it happens. But after our friend Mike Ferrin, of SiriusXM and MLB Network Radio, read the column, he had the answer. He told me, it's a clock off. I loved it. I used it. I'm in. Doug, are you in on clock off, or you have a better term?
Well, I do like clock off, but I start thinking about you're leaving the field, right? It's not a victory, right? So that's the thing. I always think of off as like you beat the team and they're walking off the field. So it's kind of a tie.
Yeah, but they're walking off the field because they weren't going to play extra innings, right? So
yeah, there's no victory, though. Yeah, I wonder if you have a victory clause in that one. Well, I thought about something like a stun off, like you stun them.
Yeah.
Almost like, it's kind of a feeling like that, or like you're sneaking off. You're more like sneaking off because it's like you're not walking off with bravado and excitement. You're kind of like sneaking and skulking off because you don't really know what happens. So it could be a baffle off because you didn't know the rule. So I think we got to work on that. But if it's about tying the game, then maybe you go to like a knot off, or like a tourniquet. Maybe you just come up with a single term, like a tourniquet. It just turns into a tie, and that's it. All circulation's cut off, and everybody's walking off the field. So, yeah, but it's something to do. He kind of undid the walk-off. It would have been a walk-off if it was ball four, but then they undid it and put the person in reverse. So it's kind of a mess right there. But the thing I really would like is, I still think they need a challenge flag. And if they do that, it's first of all, it's obvious that it has to be the color of molasses, which is like a deep brown, to indicate that it's taking forever. And I would be absolutely excited if it was like, if it wasn't molasses colored, I'd go with the Trinidadian flag in honor of my father. So you could throw that on the field. So I think there's a lot of things, a lot of ways we can go with this, for sure.
It was a stunt off. I'll accept
stunned,
that
right?
Part. I mean... It was the most what just happened moment ever. I talked to the pitcher. Okay, just nobody else wanted to talk to him, just me and him. And I said, when that happened, and that call gets made, didn't you have a what just happened moment? And he said, I honestly had no idea what happened. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know if he was out. I didn't know if he was safe. I didn't know whether we won. I didn't know what it was. And I, that's exactly right. I can tell you, Doug, I never had a harder time in my life trying to describe anything that happened in a baseball game than I had with that.
Even with Javi Baez, remember he got the rundown?
Yeah, that was a good one.
Home and first.
Yeah, that was similar, but I wasn't there in person. I was at this. And All it did was make it harder to tell the story. Look, there's way more to kick around. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to get back to this later in the show when we get to the dugout segment. I think we can still have more fun with this because that's what we do here. So stay tuned for that.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Guys tend to think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort, but it's possible to have it both ways. I'm all set for summer thanks to Mack Weldon. The Vesper polo shirt is so breathable you can wear it on the golf course, but it looks classy enough to wear to a party. The Maverick Tech chino short is ultra flexible, and the Pima crew neck t-shirt is perfect for those casual weekends. There's no need to be uncomfortable in your clothing ever again. Some guys just want to look good without calling attention to themselves. Mack Weldon apparel gives you understated good looks for understated confidence. Mack Weldon clothes are designed to fit your style and the demands of modern life. They look like regular clothes but feel like the latest in modern comfort. They're the go-to choice for guys who want to look great without even trying. Breathable underwear that keeps you cool, dry, and comfy all day. Crazy comfortable but elevated sweatpants. An upgraded classic polo with antimicrobial silver threads. An ultra-soft antimicrobial tee for when you need to stay fresh longer. That's the Silver Crew Neck T-shirt. Get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code MLBSHOW. That's MackWeldon.com. Promo code MLB Show.
All right, time to welcome in this week's very special visitor to Starkville. It's the point guard for the best TV booth in baseball. The great play-by-play voice of the Mets on SNY, Gary Cohen. Gary, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys. This is outstanding. What a special treat to be with you two.
The treat is ours. Could this really be your first visit to Starkville? Is that true?
So far. I mean, you never know what will happen after today. You may never want to have me again, but for now, this is my maiden voyage.
Okay, I'm not worried about you burning your bridges here.
You never know. It could be a 3-hour tour, like, you know, Gilligan's Island.
Yeah, you never know. That's right. All right, look, we have so much to get to. I don't know how we cannot start with the new rules and the pitch clock. I was at the crazy Red Sox Braves game that ended in that clock off call, and it was confusing, man. I'm still confused. So, I mean, you've now called some games with this clock ticking. How conscious are you as you're calling these games that clock is ticking?
You know, we've done two games so far as we speak, and we haven't had any violations in either one of those games. And the first couple of innings of the first game, I was very, very conscious of the clock, and I think the players were as well. But you forget about it. And what I've found is that the pace of the game is not particularly fast. It's just what we were used to back, say, when I started broadcasting the Mets. So we're talking about 35 years ago. This was the pace that the game was played at. And you had routine 2-hour and 20-minute, 2-hour, 30-minute games. It didn't mean you didn't have occasionally a 3 or 3.5-hour game. But this is the pace at which the game is meant to be played. And at some point, it slowed itself down to a crawl. And I think this is a welcome change. Now, are people looking for ways to mess with the rules and gain an advantage any way you can? Absolutely. We saw Max Scherzer do it yesterday. He had a situation with a runner on base where the hitter had already taken his time out. And he came set with about 11 on the pitch clock and held it down to 1. As it turned out, the hitter got a little ground ball single through the right side. But, you know, you can certainly mess with the hitter's timing if you are the pitcher. I think the pitcher has an enormous advantage. I think it's a much greater burden on the hitters because, you know, pitching is proactive and hitting is reactive. So, you know, we'll see how it plays out. But a couple of days into spring training, I think this is the greatest thing baseball has done in a long, long time.
Yeah, the games are 23 minutes faster on average so far than last spring. And that's fine with me. You know, I did watch some of that game on Sunday, and a couple of things struck me. One was Max. You know, the first inning that he pitched, oh my God, did he work fast. I was hypnotized by how fast Max Scherzer was getting the ball, locking in, and he was ready to rock. I mean,
he had an at bat against Joey Manessis. He struck him out in 27 seconds. From the start of the at bat to the end of the at bat, three pitches, 27 seconds. That's exactly the way it was going.
He's going to just lean into this in every way, isn't he?
Absolutely. He's been thinking about this for a year since before they even announced that the rules were going to be changed. He's been thinking about ways to work it to his advantage. This is what competitive people do. As Doug well knows, it will be easy at some point for everybody to adjust to the rules, but it's the most competitive guys who will take best advantage of the rules.
That's exactly right. You know, all right, one more thing that really struck me, this is kind of related development, is it felt like, all right, those 1-2-3 innings, you know, one of the fun things about watching you, Ron Darling, Keith Hernandez, is just the banter. But it felt like the banter had to be really tight because the game was zipping along. Is that something you were ready for?
You know, it's something we talked about beforehand, and it's something we're going to have to adjust to as we go. One of the things I like about the new rules is that they decided to enforce them strictly from day one. They didn't let guys ease into it, and I think that's important, especially since you have a lot of players who are going to be leaving for a period of time to play in the WBC that will not be using the rules in the tournament. So to get everybody up to speed so that a situation like you had in that Boston-Atlanta game happens in February and it doesn't happen later on in games that matter. I think the biggest impediment is going to be in close games late. That's when you really don't mind the game slowing down, where you're savoring the anticipation of every pitch. And I think it may feel a little sped up at that point, but where we'll really enjoy it is in those 10-1 games in the sixth inning, where the guy comes out of the bullpen who hasn't pitched in 10 days and is trying to make an impression on his manager and takes 45 seconds between pitches. Those are the games that are going to be tightened up and made palatable. But you know, from a broadcasting perspective, there's no question we have to adjust too. And we've certainly found that in the first two games. We need to get in and out a little faster, complete our thoughts a little better. It's a little harder to do an extended story unless you get a few foul balls. So it definitely will have an impact. I mean, you're shaving a half an hour off the time available to gab and make fools of ourselves, which, you know, might work in our favor.
Well, thank goodness we're not paid for the hour in the color analyst booth there. Right. That would be problematic.
as long as it'll pay us by the hour, I think it works to everybody's benefit.
Well, Gary, I'm curious your conversations with players about it, because it's one thing just to say, okay, it's just faster, or at least it has a better tempo. Are the players speaking anything about how it's impacting their performance? I know as a hitter, like feeling rushed or Do you feel like there's a communication around the adjustments they're making in game around it?
You know, from a hitter standpoint, you know, the Mets have two guys who have traditionally taken a long time, Mark Canha and Pete Alonso. And Canha appears to have adjusted very quickly. I think Pete's trying to figure it out. You know, he was one of those guys who would step out of the box and he'd look up and he'd take a deep breath and visualize and then take a couple of half swings. And he just doesn't have time to do that anymore. So, interestingly, in the first spring training game he played, you know, he quickened up that whole thing and he hit a home run his first time up and got base hits the next two times. So it didn't seem to affect him too much. But you know, he acknowledged that he's still trying to figure out what the best tempo is. But again, I think everybody's going to adjust. And frankly, I think one of the byproducts is going to be with pitchers working faster, I think it's going to diminish velocity somewhat. I think it also might improve control somewhat, that pitchers will be pitching in a better rhythm. And I think, again, that works to everybody's benefit, right? The decreased velocity and the better control makes for a cleaner game and maybe for a little more offense, especially when you combine it with the new shift rules.
You know, Gary, I know that Buck Showalter has some tricks up his sleeve. You know, he was peppering me with questions one day about these rules that I know I couldn't answer them. I can only imagine what Theo Epstein has heard from Buck Showalter. Okay, so what do you think some of those tricks might be?
You know, I think it's mostly about maximizing the ability of guys to have enough time. Like, for instance, we talked about Alonso. In that first spring game, there was a half inning when he was in the field, but he was due to bat first the next inning. And when the third out was made, he sprinted full speed into the dugout so he'd have a little more time. Buck has talked about taking his best bat boy on the road with him, which teams don't generally do,
because bat boy strategy,
more prepared to get the equipment into the hands of the players quicker so that they have better able to take advantage of that 30 seconds that they have between batters to come to the plate. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that Buck thinks about, because, you know, he operates on a level that most of us can never even dream of.
You don't think all 30 teams are looking at their bat boy depth chart?
So. Yeah.
So, well, and you mentioned with the, in the clock, you talked about shifting in terms of players talking about that kind of adjustment as a hitter. I mean, what have you seen so far in that regard?
Well, the left-hand hitters are thrilled. I mean, if you're Daniel Vogelbach, you just had 50 points in it to your batting average. I mean, what I'm going to find interesting are a couple of things. One, with the extreme left-hand pull hitters, the Joey Gallos of the world, how many teams will defend him by bringing the left fielder in to play that shallow right field that the, you know, the shift fielder was playing in past years? Also, what are the gaps going to be on the left side of the infield against those left-hand hitters? Are you going to play the third baseman closer to home, or are you going to crowd him with the shortstop? Because I know Francisco Lindor talked about this last year, that he felt as though sometimes his fellow fielders were too close to him and he'd rather have more room to range. So I think that's going to be a team-by-team adjustment. Your second baseman, do you play him more toward the hole, or do you take away more of the middle, play the first baseman further off the bag so he can cover more ground on that right side? I think everybody's going to be trying to figure those things out as we go, because, you know, the solutions that were available last year against, particularly against the left-hand pull hitters, are no longer available. So I think it's going to be fascinating to watch how teams adjust.
Yeah, we'll be digging in on this stuff all spring and certainly all season. Let's turn to the Mets, okay? Because I know I've always wondered what a $355 million baseball team might look like. And now we know. So as you look at the Mets right now, as those palm trees are fluttering in the breeze, how much better do you think that they could be than last year?
I don't think the goal is to be better than last year in the regular season. I think anybody would sign up for 101 wins right now. And I think what the Mets did by spending $355 million was really stay about the same. I mean, when you think about what they did, they re-signed Nimmo, which they really had to do. They re-signed Diaz, so that gives them the closer that dominated the game last year. So they stayed the same at those positions. They replaced DeGrom with Verlander. I think that's a pretty even trade. They replaced Taijuan Walker and Chris Bassitt with Kodai Senga, who's the biggest wild card in all this, and Jose Quintana, and I think they probably stayed about the same in those 3 and 4 starter roles. So their offensive team is basically the same. They swapped out James McCann and brought in Omar Narvaez as part of their catching tandem, but otherwise it's the same team. Now, their young players are a little closer to being ready, the Brett Beatty's, Francisco Alvarez's, Mark Vientos's, and Ronnie Mauricio's. So they've got those position players, you know, rising, all of whom might help them at some point during the season. The bullpen's a little bit better. They brought in David Robertson, who takes Seth Lugo's spot, and they brought in Brooks Raley, who gives them a lefty that they didn't have last year. So on the margins in the bullpen, they're a little bit better. But really, because they didn't have the super pitching prospects ready in the minor leagues, they basically had to spend as much money as they did to stay the same. And I think, again, anybody would sign up for 101 wins, just hoping maybe that the Braves don't win as many and hoping that maybe it's not the Phillies who go to the World Series this year. It's the Mets. I mean, those three teams are going to have an incredible battle. Last year was the Mets and Braves pulling away and the Braves overlapping the Mets in the last week. But, you know, the Phillies having the last laugh. Who knows what happens among the three of them this year? I do know that all three of them will have fewer opportunities to beat up on the Marlins and the Nationals because of the new schedule. And so that changes the dynamic a little bit also.
Yeah, you know, that's a really interesting question. It's such a monster division. Do you see anything that right now in February separates one of these teams, Mets, Braves, Phillies, from the others?
Well, I think the Phillies got better. I mean, just by signing Trey Turner, they got better. But I think their bullpen is also deeper now. You know, bringing in Kimbrel is a big piece. Matt Strom is a big piece. They've got a better bullpen. They brought in Taijuan Walker from the Mets to solidify their rotation. And I think they're younger players. I mean, bringing in Brandon Marsh last year was a really underrated move. He did such a great job for them and made them a much better defensive team, where obviously they were lacking earlier in the year. Bryson Stott got better as the year went along. Alec Bohm got better as the year went along. So I think the Phillies are better than they were last year. But, you know, they only won 87 games in the regular season, 14 games behind the Mets and the Braves. So they had some ground to make up as far as the division is concerned. And the Braves are, you know, pretty much the same. I mean, they've got incredible young talent that you would assume is going to be on the rise. The big question is at shortstop with Dansby Swanson gone and Vaughn Grissom trying to take his place. But they also get Mike Soroka back. Hopefully his hamstring is better now that he's overcome 2 years with the Achilles injury. You know, so that solidifies their young rotation even further. So I think all teams are going to be really good. I think all three are capable of winning 95 to 100 games, and, you know, that makes for a great pennant race. And, you know, I loved the unbalanced schedule. I loved 19 games against division rivals. I think rivalries are what the game is all about. I am not a proponent of playing as many interleague games as you are now and playing everybody. You can see everybody on TV. You know, every game's on every night. There's no reason that you have to bring every team into every stadium. I think that the schedule is way too diluted now. I liked it the way it was, but, you know, this is going to be different and everybody's going to have to be able to prepare for every team in baseball at some point. But it certainly doesn't make the division races as interesting coming down the stretch, not playing as many games against your own group.
Well, you know, somebody has written about this and actually talked to the Braves coaches about it the other day. There is another side to it when you've got a division like this where potentially you've got three playoff teams in one division. It really makes the wild card race more fair. You know, there was such a disparity between the number of games that the NL East teams had to play against winning teams versus like the Central last year. And you know, I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but if I remember this correctly, I think the Cardinals only played 60 games against teams with winning records, and the NL East teams are playing 80. And so there's a lot to be said for if you have a wild card race, 90 wins means the same thing in the NL East as it means if you do it in the NL Central.
Well, the Mets will argue that over the years they've been penalized more than any team in interleague play, and they'll continue to be because they have to play extra games against the Yankees every year. So,
yeah, and there's also that.
Well, Gary, I'm curious about how you look at last season, you know, the reflection upon this great year. And I was in Atlanta for that last series where it just sort of stopped. And I guess DeGrom is the centerpiece of those questions. I mean, how do you now contextualize that after kind of seeing the team? And I guess how do they talk about it looking forward?
You know, the funny thing is that all year long, the questions were about the Mets offense. You know, do they have enough power? Do they have enough run scoring ability? And as it turned out, they were not a great power hitting team, but they were an awfully good run scoring team. The assumption was that once you got to the short series, whether it was late in the year or in the postseason, that the Mets' 1-2 punch at the front of their rotation with DeGrom and Scherzer would be able to dominate, and that would get the Mets deep into the postseason. Well, as it turned out, when they got to the biggest games of the year, they played six of them, three against the Braves on the last weekend of the season and three against the Padres, and they got poor starting pitching in five of those six games. The only well-pitched game was DeGrom in game two against the Padres, and that was a good start, not a great one. Scherzer, you know, battled that oblique injury in the middle of the season, came back, looked like he was fairly healthy, but, you know, I think he tweaked it again in September, and he certainly was not himself in either of his two starts against the Braves and the Padres. So, you know, they've put themselves in the same position this year where they're going to be very dependent on the top two guys in their rotation. Now it's Scherzer and Verlander, and you know, one is 38 going on 39. It'll be 39 by October, and the other one is 40. So you worry about that because the average age of the Mets starting pitching staff is 35, and overall they'll probably have the oldest team in the majors. So I think the faster games will help in terms of keeping people healthy, but it's certainly going to be the main area of concern. And you know, you prepare the best you can for the best possible outcomes when the games mean the most. But as you guys know as well as anybody, in a short series, it's a crapshoot. It's all about how well you're playing at that time, how healthy you are at that time. And the Mets did not get the best out of their best two players, Scherzer and DeGrom, at the most important time.
All right, I got a fun question for you about Scherzer and Verlander. They're honestly two of my favorite pitchers to watch ever. But you just mentioned one's 38, one's 40. Here's the question. Last year, Max and DeGrom made 34 starts between them. Do Scherzer and Verlander make more than that or fewer than that at their age?
Well, they better make more than that or the Mets aren't going anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Verlander last year arguably had one of the most stunning years that any pitcher has ever had. When you consider his age and coming off Tommy John surgery, to put up that kind of year, 1.75 ERA at age 39, I mean, he is just an off-the-charts competitor and a guy who fashions himself as a latter-day Tom Brady. A guy who can pitch at that level till he's 45. I'm not even going to say Nolan Ryan because, you know, he was on a Mount Olympus all by himself in terms of his longevity as a power pitcher. And I think Max feels similarly, that because he is a guy who is fastidious about the way he cares for himself and the way that he has adjusted over the years, that he can continue to be successful well into his 40s. It remains to be seen. I think it's certainly the biggest question about this team. But, yeah, if the two of them don't make more starts than Scherzer and DeGrom made last year, then the Mets, for all the money that they spent, have a significant problem.
Yeah, I agree. All right, look, I want to talk a little bit about you and your career because I cannot believe that you and Ron and Keith are about to start. It's your 18th season together. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
The longest run of any three-man booth in history?
I don't think that's strictly true. I think that...
just Skip Mets Carey, history, is it?
Yeah, Mets history. Skip Carey, Pete Van Wehren, and Ernie Johnson, I think they had 33 years,
okay,
the three of them together. Lindsey Nelson, Bob Murphy, Ralph Kiner, the original three broadcasters for the Mets, they had a 17-year run together.
All right, so you grew up a Mets fan. Mm-hmm. If I had told you, when you were 12 years old, that you would wind up not just calling games of the team you rooted for, but you would be in a booth together with your guys longer than Lindsey Nelson, Bob Murphy, and Ralph Kiner, what would you have said?
Well, when I was 12, I still aspired to be the shortstop for the Mets. and that thing really did not work out very well. I had limited skills.
Lindor, very close.
Yeah, my second biggest dream was to be a power forward for the Knicks. you know, lack of that appropriate height and a lack of skill precluded that. So, At that age, I wasn't even thinking about the possibility that this was the career that I was going to pursue, but it's amazing. I mean, I grew up listening to Bob and Lindsay and Ralph. I had them on my transistor radio under my pillow for West Coast night games. I mean, they were the soundtrack of my summers, and they were the voices that meant Mets baseball. Just to have the opportunity to sit next to Bob Murphy for 15 years in the radio booth. I mean, I pinched myself every day that this was actually happening. I was a radio chauvinist, and I really had no intention of ever moving over to TV. But when SNY started, they courted me, and I reluctantly accepted. I never could have dreamed it would have gone this well. I mean, I think that Keith and Ron and I have had a really special bond, and I think it started from day one, because honestly, when they put us together in 2006, none of us really had any idea what we were doing. I mean, I was a radio guy moving to TV. Keith had kind of dabbled, but he hadn't taken it seriously. And Ronnie had done 1 year in Washington with very little direction and really was not particularly accomplished. And so I think we all leaned on each other from day one. And I think that is a big piece of why we've been as successful as we have, because, you know, nobody wants to be the star. Everybody allows everybody else to shine. We genuinely get along with each other, and we have a lot of fun. And I think, you know, I think being in a dark room when we started and not really knowing what direction we were going, we kind of had to hold hands to find our way. And I think we've done that.
Well, Gary, I know a lot of times in baseball you talk about pay it forward. It's such a mentorship. I guess what's that been like? You mentioned as a young kid loving the Mets as a fan, but now you're in this chair and you're offering insights and wisdom. Have you had that chance to really pass it on, pay it forward?
Oh, yeah. I talk to young broadcasters all the time. And in fact, the Mets are bringing in two guys in their 20s this year to work with Howie Rose on radio. Keith Radd, who had been in Brooklyn doing A-ball games, who I just heard him first two games that he did. He's a star in the making. And Pat McCarthy, Tom's son, is going to be doing the pre and post and probably about 40 games on play-by-play when Howie's off. Pat's a great young broadcaster, and I've known him since he was a little kid. So, talking to those guys, I just got an email from a college freshman at North Carolina yesterday looking for advice. I try to be as helpful and as honest with all of those young broadcasters as I can. But one of the things that has really impressed me over the last dozen years or so is how much young talent is coming into our business. I think there was a while there where I felt as though some of the people who would be best suited to being broadcasters were choosing other fields. But I think that it's become, because of the spread of different cable networks and the greater availability of sports on radio and TV, has attracted more really bright, talented young people into the business. And I really enjoyed talking to them, and I try to do as much as I can for them.
Well, Gary, you are so good at what you do that I would honestly stop what I was doing and tune in to listen to you ordering a pizza. And I mean that.
You know, but I really love the mushrooms, the anchovies. Not a big fan of the pineapple. The Hawaiian pizza, I could really do without.
All right, we're gonna do a Gary Orders Pizza segment before we get out of here. But I want to talk about an epic call you made a few years back. You and I have talked about it before. We need to hear it one more time.
Looking for his first hit of the year. Oh. He drives one deep left field. That goes Upton back near the wall. It's out of here. Bartolo has done it. The impossible has happened. The team vacates the dugout as Bartolo takes the long trot, his first career home run. And there will be nobody in the dugout to greet him. This is one of the great moments in the history of baseball.
Ah, goosebumpy. All right, let me ask you about two things that you said there. The impossible has happened. How impossible did that seem until it happened?
Well, you had to have watched Bartolo over his previous two seasons with the Mets. The utter futility of Bartolo at the plate when he first joined them was so comical, it was riveting. I mean, he would swing and miss, and his helmet would fly off, and his body would go in one direction, and his bat would go in another direction, and he had no chance. I mean, there was no chance. However, he did work at it, and that was in May of that season, and earlier in the year, he had had a couple of hits, couple of hard hit balls down the line, but still, I mean, he was 42 years old. Nobody that old had ever hit their first major league home run. And I mean, he's big and strong, so you figure if you got it on the fat part of the bat, I guess it was conceivable. But I think when we talked about it earlier, Jason, one of the things that I said was that there are certain moments in baseball that you can't anticipate, right? Somebody's approaching a record, or a team's about to clinch, or you're in a situation for a game-winning hit. You know, you're kind of at the edge of your seat and ready for it. But here's a situation where it's a May game, the pitcher's up, you're ready to talk about anything, but you're sitting back in your chair, and this happens. And I think that's what makes the game so delightful. And it's, you know, maybe I'm biased, but one of the things that's unfortunate about the way the game has now developed is that that moment is not possible anymore. And yeah. I think that takes a little bit of the joy out of the game, because, you know, as much as pitchers were known for their hitting futility, every once in a while, those things would happen, and they brought such great joy.
You know, you're preaching to the choir there, man.
Yeah, oh, for
and
sure.
We've gotten a lot of entertainment.
Well, remember Scherzer gave up that grand slam off of a pitcher, right? Remember, yes, Scherzer did. Gave up? That was like
to a relief pitcher. Guy never had a hit before or since.
How about the game that the first time Clemens faced the Mets after he hit Piazza in the head in the World Series was 2 years later, and Sean Estes was even though he wasn't on the team when Piazza got hit, and so he was supposed to hit Clemens, but he missed him and he threw it behind him. But then he came up against Roger and he hit a home run against him. It was the best revenge of all. So I mean, those things, again, they're not possible anymore, but we move on.
All right, the second thing that stood out about your call, I mean, many things did, but one of the great moments in the history of baseball. So we got Aaron's 755th homer, Rose passes Ty Cobb, and Bartolo's homer. That about right?
Here's all I know. You said, what are we, 8 years later? And we're still talking about it.
That's right.
Right? I mean, it's when Met fans talk about their favorite moments, there's Andy Chavez's catch, which came in a loss, and that since the Mets last won the World Series. Those are the most favorite moments that I hear about from Met fans. So, I mean, I might have been a little bit tongue-in-cheek when I said that at the time, but the fact is that it has endured in a way that few moments have. So take it for what it's worth.
Yeah, right.
Well, speaking of Met fans, Gary, you know, I grew up in North Jersey, Teaneck, so I knew a lot of Met fans. I still know a lot here in Connecticut. And I know some of them are having a little trouble being kind of like the favorite in some ways. You know, like, it's like, I don't know what to do with all this money. I'm supposed to complain that we don't have enough money. I mean, what have you heard about the tone of that? Because I feel like a lot of Met fans are struggling being in this, like, financial advantageous position that they're in.
Yeah, you know, I kind of liken it to the Red Sox fans for all those years after they last won it in 1918. And, you know, they loved being the fans who were never fulfilled. Same with the Cub fans to a certain extent. But, you know, once Red Sox fans got the taste of it, all of a sudden they became the spoiled fans like the Yankee fans used to be. So things, you have to adjust over time. You know, the Cubs won a World Series. Red Sox have won multiple World Series. Maybe the Mets' time has come. It's been since 1986. You know, my partners are revered for having been a part of the Mets' last championship, but I think they're a little tired of that having been the Mets' last championship. So if they have to spend the most money to win a title, I think they'd be in favor of that. But, you know, as we've been talking, there are no guarantees. I mean, the Angels have spent a lot of money over the last dozen years, and they have two of the best players in the history of the game. But they haven't won anything since 2002. So nothing is guaranteed. You still have to play 162 games, and, you know, a month from now, we'll be ready for that.
Well, they're definitely built to win the World Series. All you have to do is just actually do that.
Right.
Seems easy enough. Hey, before we let you go, Gary, I want to ask you about one more epic call of yours that always makes me smile. You don't know what I'm going to get to, do you? It's the bug call. You're doing a game between the Mets and the Marlins. This is last year, am I right? And there's
I think it was during the was it last year or was it during the year we called the games remotely? I'm not certain.
Okay, I can't remember myself anymore. But there's it's Mets, Marlins, and there's a bug on the camera behind home plate. Here's how you turn that little buggy ride into broadcasting magic.
There's a bug right on the infield. It's moving in from the mound. It's heading toward the plate. It's veering off toward third base. Oh, it's making a beeline for the catcher.
Some might argue that's the best bug we use every any night.
It's heading for the wall. It's out of here. The bug is out of here.
You know, I took a little inspiration from Kevin Harlan, who's become the master at calling the miscreants running on the field or an animal running across the football field. So Kevin has become the standard by which all others are judged on the alien presence on the broadcast and doing play-by-play of such. So I took a little inspiration there.
See, you could have ignored that bug. You went the other way. You leaned into all access bug coverage.
We, you know, when we put up a graphic that's misspelled, we don't ignore it. We go right for it. You know, it's live TV. All sorts of stuff happens, and I think that people really enjoy if you enjoy the glitches. I remember one time we were doing a game at Citi Field, or maybe it was at Shea Stadium. And it had to be Shea Stadium. And Pedro Martinez was pitching. And in the middle of the inning, the sprinklers went off on the infield. And, you know, there are certain pitchers who would have been upset and let it throw them. Pedro started dancing through the raindrops. And so you gotta go with the flow. And I think that that's a big part of what live TV is all about. We're not perfect. The broadcast isn't perfect. The announcers aren't perfect. And if there's a way of making light of whatever is going on, we're going to go straight into the light.
Yes, I love it. I love it. Yes, the improv. And
yes, and. Yes. That's improv. Yes, and.
You're talking to
Yeah, no. Okay. Yeah, it's go ahead, Jay.
No, I was going to say, you're talking to two guys who went golfing with Kyle Schwarber and JT Realmuto on our last show and didn't even know we were.
There you go.
But that's how the show, like, they did their show from a golf cart.
We did it.
Okay. Totally. Let's do that.
So, well, one thing I wanted to find out with Gary was like with Buck Showalter, who was my manager in Texas. And is there any one story that stands out about like working with Buck? It's like, it's always majestic every day.
All I can tell you is every day, I mean, the man is 66, 67 years old. Every day he comes with energy. Every day he comes with stories. He comes with an agenda. He may not always directly answer the question you're asking him, but the answer is always fascinating and sometimes Absolutely. Goes in a direction that you could never have anticipated. He is the master of all he surveys. He sees everything. He takes note of everything. He questions everything that he doesn't quite understand. Some of the questions might be a little, you know, passive aggressive, but still he knows exactly what he's doing and what he's seeing and what he wants to accomplish at all times. There is nothing that gets by him. I am never-endingly fascinated by this man. He is he's one of the more cerebral and unique individuals I've ever met in the game.
Your network televises his post-game Q&A with the media, and that is one wild ride, man. It
is something, right? Pre-game, post-game, every day. It's always fascinating. Do not tune away.
For sure. All right. I know it's time to let you go, but we started this. We're going to finish this. This is the moment that you've waited for. Gary Cohen is going to order an imaginary pizza.
Well, I'd like it 18 inches. I'd like it with a thick crust, and I would like anchovies and mushrooms and half of it with pepperoni. Could you have it here in 20 minutes?
I can't, no. There's somebody else you could call that could probably pull it off. Doug and I are not that person. But I think we proved we really can get sheer joy out of hearing Gary Cohen order pizza. All right, so, Gary, you're the best. It was awesome to talk to you. I can't thank you enough for fitting us in. I look forward to seeing you down the road. Have a great spring and come back again sometime, okay?
Thank you, guys. It was fantastic being with you. And good luck. This is this podcast has just gone through the roof. I'm very, very impressed, but it shouldn't surprise me at all. You guys are the best.
When you get injured, you don't want to wait for answers and options. That's why it may be time to explore the Nano Experience, a revolutionary treatment option designed to help active people get back to the lifestyles they love. Nanotechnology allows surgeons to see inside even the smallest joints and treat orthopedic conditions with a tiny camera and other nano instrumentation, all through a barely there poke hole incision. Wherever you've experienced an injury, whether it be a foot and ankle, hand and wrist, shoulder and elbow, knee or hip, nanoarthroscopy can be used to diagnose and treat your condition in an extremely, minimally invasive way. Don't wait to learn about the revolutionary Nano Experience and how it could help you or someone you know after an injury. Visit arthrex.info/theathletic. This is not medical advice and is not meant to be a substitute for advice from your physician. Talk with your physician about your health condition, potential surgical risks, and whether Arthrex products are right for you. Postoperative management is patient-specific and dependent upon your physician's assessment. Individual results will vary.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Okay, it's that time again. It's time for listener trivia, our way of involving you, our favorite listeners, in this show. Doug, we somehow got one right on our last show, so I think that means we're batting, what, 1,000 in spring training? Is that pretty much what you hit in your career in the spring?
Well, you don't forget the 5,000 OPS. I wanted to throw that in there, so yes.
Yes, we're What's our well. OPS in trivia?
Yeah, 5,001 in trivia.
5,001?
Yes.
Well, we get an extra credit for actually getting the question right. Okay, 5,001. Let's go with that. I'm not sure we'll be hitting 1,000 or 5,001 after this week, but that's why we play the games. So let's bring in this week's special trivia guest star. It's Tom Robeson. Tom, welcome back to Starkville.
Thanks so much, guys. It's great to be here again.
Glad to have you here. It's your first appearance in quite a while, so let's remind the audience where you're from, what team you root for, what inspired this question.
Well, I grew up in Philadelphia. I currently live in Central Illinois, where I'm a college professor. But because I grew up in Philadelphia, I am a diehard Phillies fan. It's much better to be a Phillies fan right now than the last time I was on with y'all. it's nice to be in a spring and feeling, I think the word is hopeful. I'm thrilled to be here. You put out the call for trivia and asked for NL East trivia, and
I did.
I've got 30 some years of being an NL East follower, so I thought I might have something for you.
All right, well, your question's really hard. It's harder than I thought it was when I first read it, but I think it's time for you to ask it so we can get it wrong. We'll get that part of the show out of the way. So Tom, which What's your question?
I've got faith in you guys this week. So here's the question. There is only one member of the 300 home run club that has played for three of the current NL East franchises. Who is it?
Okay. As I said, when I first saw this, I thought we should definitely get this. And then the more I thought about it, I thought we will definitely not get this. So I tried to think about these teams and go through them one by one. So before we start, can I ask you a question? You did use the word franchise, so I'm just making sure that means this is a player who could have used, who could have played for either the Expos or the Nationals. That's right.
I have actually only done it for the Nationals. I decided to keep it clean, not dealing with any sort of legacy. So if they played for the Expos, it's not going to be in here.
All right.
Really?
All right.
Wow, my best guess, my two best guesses were former Expos. So now I'm really confused. Okay,
it
so
it doesn't have to be the Nationals, though, because it's three out of the five.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So, but all right, just since we're there, this might be a hint, but is this a guy who played in this era of the NL East, or is it possible he played before there was any such thing as like the Marlins?
I don't know. It's spring training, hopes eternal. Sure, I'll give you the hint. Yes, it's the current era.
Okay. All right, Doug, I was thinking a little bit more back in time. The first guy I thought of was Moises Alou. Played for the Marlins, played for the Expos. Not sure he was ever a Met. Yeah, I'm going to say no, but Marlins. He did get around. And I don't, like, he was never a National, so he's out. And then I was thinking, I decided it had to be Andres Galarraga. Definitely a Brave, definitely an Expo. I was almost sure he was a Marlin. He must have hit 300 home runs. So that I was all locked in on that. I stopped thinking. I did write down some other names, but again, they're guys pre-Nationals. Ron Gant, Jay Bruce, Tony Perez, Gary Carter. I mean, I know they played for two teams. I don't know if they played for a third in the division.
Jay Bruce, that's interesting.
All right, hey, before I turn this over to you, one other thing I think we should take as a hint is Tom did pick 300 homers.
Yes.
So did he do that just to make this harder, or did he do it because this is a guy who hit between 300
it
and 400? My guess is it's somebody who was in the 300s.
Yes, that sounds good. Who is that?
Well, what did you come up with? If there's no Expos here, then I'm really in trouble.
Okay, well, I mean, I was just trying to think of who played for these three teams. And, I mean, now, of course, you know I have a tremendous blind spot for my own era, so that's going to be a problem. But so I'm hoping he didn't play.
This guy came from your era on.
Well, hopefully I didn't play with him, at least. That's what I'm thinking, you know, so I could be wrong, but I'm thinking about this. Well, all right, I'm going to throw some names out. You know, we should go with the usual suspects that have played for everybody. What about like a Nelson Cruz? Did he play for all these teams? That's somebody I thought about. You know, let's think about that.
Played for the Expos. Who else did he play for? He didn't play for the Mets.
Did he play for the Nationals?
He played for the Nationals.
No Mets. No Marlins. He played for the Marlins.
No Mets, no Phillies.
No Braves. I mean, he played for everybody. So, all right. What about... This was the wild card I thought about. Edwin Encarnacion. Because he had... That's a lot of home runs, right? Didn't he play for, like, everybody? Braves? Didn't he play for the Braves? Definitely the Marlins.
The thing is, he got to be a DH so fast.
Yeah, but, I mean, he played for a ton of teams.
Yeah, okay.
All right, you like that one? Maybe?
Let me think. I don't remember him playing for the Braves. I don't remember. He didn't play for the Phillies. Marlins, Nationals. When did he play for the Nationals? All right, who else you got?
What about Gary Sheffield? Did he play for a lot of his team?
Gary Sheffield's always a good guess. Braves, for sure. Marlins, for sure.
Yeah, so at least
Mets,
two.
For sure. Did he? Okay. Wasn't he a Met? Definitely a Yankee.
He was definitely a Yankee.
I like that one.
You like that one? Okay.
That's the best name.
Beltran? We've dredged up so far. Carlos Beltran?
No.
Mets? Remember he was traded like 12 times in one offseason? I thought he...
See, I thought about Piazza because he was Mets and Marlins in a week. Same week.
I did have
but,
him.
But he, yeah, that's it. That's 13 for him.
What about like Pudge Rodriguez? Did he have 300 runs? Or Conine? Any of those guys? 300 home runs? Sounds like a lot.
Conine went Marlins, Phillies, and Mets. I don't think he would have 300?
Yeah, that's a tough one.
That's a good guess. And Pudge? I don't think Pudge got to 300. I like the Gary Sheffield pick. It's probably wrong, but...
You like Sheffield?
Yeah, I do.
Oh,
all right, so... Doug, I know you like to complain some weeks that we need to come up with too many answers. 4, 5, 6. Don't like those. Too many.
No, this is good. Because I feel like I've been made educated guesses. That makes me feel good.
Right, but okay, when it's one... Yeah. Isn't it even harder because either we get it right or we go up in flames, as we usually do? We don't get partial credit.
But I feel like we get it wrong with flair and grace and class when it's one. Because we're like, all right, yeah, that was a pretty good guess, you know?
Okay, flair, grace, class. Let's go with that. Yes. All right, Tom. Is there any chance that the answer to this is Doug Glanville's pick, Gary Sheffield?
So here's the fun thing, guys. You're right. I had it wrong. There's two of them, and I just looked it up. Sheff makes it. You've got Gary Sheffield. You are correct.
Oh, we got two. Oh, wait a minute. We got two answers. All right.
Producer failure on this one, too.
Wow. Yeah. What's happening?
It's like the pitch clock. It's like technicality. I love
this. This is a whole new development here in Starkville where we get the question right, and the guy who asked the question and the producer get it wrong. I love this.
Yeah,
this is the greatest trivia segment ever.
I missed Sheff in a Met right there at the end of his career.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Wow, how about that? All right, but now, who was the other?
Right, who was the other?
Like, he doesn't count now.
Guess him, I guess.
You're never going to get the other one.
Never going to get the other one.
Wait. Someone like Steve Finley or someone like that? All right, let's think about all right, yeah.
We're not going to answer it. Let's just rest on our laurels, okay? We got the one we're supposed to get.
Yeah,
the rest is all on them.
You want to hear the other one?
Yes.
The other one is very randomly Jose Bautista, who played for Atlanta, the Phillies, and the Mets all in the same season.
It was like That's right.
That is so wild.
And he did homer for all three of those teams during that season.
He did. He hit one for the Phillies.
He had two for the Phillies, nine for the Mets or something. Yeah, it was.
Right. He had one on that run, same season. Yeah, that was the last season of his career. Yeah.
All right. Let me just get a ruling. All right. Does this make us 2 for 2 this spring?
Yeah. You guys got it right. Absolutely. You're 2 for 2 this spring and 2 for 4 on the year, which is pretty good, too. Mm.
Yeah, it must be the grouper sandwiches, huh? 2 for 2 in the spring.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, the best news of the day is the portion of the segment that involves us is over, and the best part of the segment is now, because that's the part where we bring in the mayor of Starkville, Tim McMaster, to play some fabulous play-by-play clip involving one of this week's answers, and I guess we know which one.
It is.
Tim, what do you got?
It is not Gary Sheffield. It is Jose Bautista, and we went with a fitting one because who is our guest this week? Gary Cohen. So we're going to go with one of his Mets home runs. In fact, Jose Bautista's only career walk-off home run came with the Mets. That was back July 6th, 2018.
Frazier carrying the winning run at third with two out. Bautista sucks one to deep left field, and this ball game is over. A walk-off grand slam for Jose Bautista, the first walk-off home run of his major league career.
Not just a walk-off, walk-off slam for the Mets.
They walked Nimmo to get to him.
Slap in the face.
How'd that work out? All right, Tom, what a great question. Can't tell you how much we appreciate your taking the time to come up with a question and join us here in Starkville. So thank you, my friend.
Thanks, guys. It's really a pleasure.
Sliding, catching, and going into the dugout.
Hey, what do you say we take another trip to the dugout? That's where Doug Glanville hangs out this time of year in a in, imparts his always amusing brand of baseball wisdom on us. And usually we ask Doug to tell us stories in the dugout, but this week, let's just say Doug had so much he wanted to riff on about the clock off game that we're going to go right back to that well because it's bottomless. It really is. Okay, so let's start with terminology, Doug, in that yes. clock off game, because instead of the strikeout looking, this is a Scott Fransky line, we had the strikeout yes. not looking. So what's the symbol and the terminology for the strikeout not looking?
Well, it's funny you say that. I was totally unprepared for the moment, but I did happen to have time to draw a new logo.
You did,
and I have to give a. I don't know what the copyright infringement questions are, because I did live in an area that had the Circle K. But I think this is the new strikeout for when you get clocked out, okay? So you see what I did here? There's a circle, and then you put a K in there, and then you put the time stamp around. So that is going to be the clock-off strikeout. So I think we have the backwards K, we have the regular K, and now we have the strikeout by clock. And I think it just makes perfect sense. I put the 60 seconds. I should probably have it like 8 seconds or something like that. I am open to new interpretation. So we're going to start with that. So because I was having trouble with my scorebook. I was like, I want to describe what happened. And I can't do it with a K or a backwards K. That doesn't make sense. So I figured I'd combine the two elements with the Circle K, which is a franchise out there. So we could work out the licensing agreement at some point. If Circle K cancels this, then I will turn the K on its side and I will lay it down and then the K part will face upwards. This is the new symbol. You put it in your scorebook and it tells a story in the picture. So I think we're going to go with this.
It does. Fransky texted me a picture of an upside down K asleep.
Yeah, so I like that.
That would also work. All right, here's another terminology question. And this is one that I struggled with after that game. Can we say a guy, quote unquote, drew a walk when he walked on a pitch that was never thrown? That's what he thought he did. He didn't technically do it.
Well, this is obvious. I mean, you've already stated it, so I'm just going to restate it. It is a sleepwalk. Okay? You didn't walk. You sleptwalk. So we're just going to combine the two and call it a sleepwalk. You didn't know what happened. You didn't earn it. You just woke up on first base. And that's how we sum it up. So we get one of those hats and we put the Z's over it on the scorebook. So if you have the Circle K, the sleepwalk sign will be a walk, the double B. They'll be shaped like beds. There'll be sheep involved and there'll be Z's over it. And that's what you put in your scorebook. So very easy.
I like that a lot. That there is some sleepwalking involved, that's for sure. Okay, well, what about the two-strike strikeout? Because that's what actually happened in that game. What do we want to do about that?
Well, I think of it sort of, we were always wondering, because of course this is the stuff that excites us, that whenever the ghost runner or the zombie runner or whatever they call the Manfred man goes on second base to lead off the inning, then guy hits a home run. It's a leadoff two-run homer.
Yes.
So we have to work with that kind of framework. So I think we think of it as the two-strike strikeout. Or I'm really excited about the possibility that someone could strike out for three pitches in a row, all on clock violations. That's what I want to understand. And I think it's instead of just coming up with a term, I think you get a sponsor out of that. If you strike out with three pitches without swinging the bat or a pitcher throwing the ball, it's like almost like an intentional walk. It's like an intentional strikeout. So we're going to have to come up with a term to sum it up. But I do like the sort of intentional strikeout. And I don't know where the credit goes, but all of a sudden you're just out. And that's what happened to the Braves. And lesson learned.
Yes. All right, here's another one. You kind of touched on this with your flag concept. But
yes.
Here's what I've noticed. When there's one of these timer violation calls, and I've seen a few, nobody knows what the heck was just called. There's no announcement. Yeah. There's nothing. It's just a lot of arm waving. How should the officials signal these calls to get our attention? Like, besides flags, is there anything you think they can learn from the other sports?
Well, I do like the flag. I was thinking that the flag could be also like a challenge. I think you go the other way on it. You should be able to challenge time itself. You say, well, was it 8 seconds or was it 7.5 seconds? I mean, like, think about basketball for a second. You know, when you have the 10 seconds to get over the half court when you're dribbling up. And you know how the referee just kind of counts out with his arm? 1, 2. Is that exactly 1 second? It probably isn't. So if you appealed that, I think he would lose in a court of law, just like appealing a ticket. So I think there needs to be a challenge flag. As I mentioned earlier, it should be, of course, the color of molasses, since we're talking about time and slowness. And then maybe you have a black hole involved there. And then from there, I said the other option would be completely selfish, and you make it a Trinidadian flag in honor of my dad. So I'll accept that, as the Trinidadian flag would symbolize challenging time itself.
I feel like we have actually challenged time itself. It doesn't go that well, though. Time always wins the challenge, but that's a whole other topic. All right, one more. This is actually very similar vein. Is there some way that you think teams can avoid these delay of game calls altogether? You know, you can't step out of the box now if you're the hitter. You can't step off the mound if you're the pitcher. Do you have any good ideas for what teams can do?
Absolutely. I could confirm but unconfirm that the Tampa Bay Rays are working on this as we speak. And it's very simple. Time travel. It's just time travel. So just imagine you could actually control the time, and therefore people have no idea. And if you freeze it in some way, then the clock doesn't tick, right? It's just like, and that's how we were playing baseball before the clock, right? It was just, it was endless time. It was infinity. So if you control time now, and everybody else is walking around like zombies and not knowing what's going on, once the Rays come up with a way to control time, you're going to win 162-0. So I think that's the simple solution. And whether you have to go back to the future and call, you know, Marty McFly and find a DeLorean that goes into 1985, whatever it takes, I think that's the clear answer to how to get ahead in the time strategy spectrum. Yes.
Well, like, if you could actually do that, you could use it for way more than just avoiding time clock violations. You would go back in time to before you hung that slider, wouldn't you? That old Steve Goodman song, videotape. If your life was on videotape, everything would be in great shape or something. And if your head hurt the morning after, you'd roll it back to late last night. That whole thing. That's kind of where you're at now.
I don't think we've gotten time travel past 8 seconds yet, but if we get past that, then we'll have a new discussion, and MLB would have to reconvene and limit time travel. So I understand that.
You want to be a member of the time travel committee? You should be. Listen, everybody, when you're confused by the rules and you don't know who to call, you know who you should turn to, right? It's not even a question. Doug Glanville. He's got all the answers. He's always had all the answers. And here's the good news. Doug will be performing this act right here all season long on Starkville. All right, that's going to do it for this week's show. We'll be bringing you podcast magic just like this all spring training long on the Athletic Baseball Show, which is available in its entirety, absolutely free, everywhere you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to read any of the incredible spring training coverage in The Athletic, you know you've come to the right place. If you just go to theathletic.com/baseballshow and you're a new subscriber, you can subscribe for just $1.99 a month for the next 12 months. Also remember, you too can be part of this podcast. Every show, we pick some fun listener trivia question. Then that lucky listener gets to join us right here and prove once again, there's almost no baseball trivia question we can't get wrong, unless the guy asking the question gets it wrong, which apparently sometimes happens. I digress. If you'd like to join us, you can email us a question at starkville@theathletic.com. We've got some email questions backlogged, so we'll get to them. Or you can find us at the Twitter. Doug Glanville is still findable at the Twitter. Am I right, Doug?
I am. It is at Doug Glanville. Very, very unique right there. DougGlanville. Hit me.
As long as you can spell, you're in good shape. You don't have to spell my whole name, just the first name. At JaySonST. Jason with a Y, S-T. Please remember to hashtag those questions. hashtag StarkvilleQS. So, Doug, thanks for playing. Thanks to Gary Cohen for visiting us. Thanks to Tom Robeson for the great trivia question. Thanks to the mayor of Starkville, Tim McMaster, for producing us and putting up with us. And thanks to you all for listening. Doug and I will be seeing you soon on Starkville.